So we've been looking at the order and indeed the chapter as bodhisattva, as a manifestation of non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, according to Bhante. And we've been seeing that really the chapter exists for that purpose. That's why we have chapters, in order, in the end, to manifest that non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy. That's why Bhante established the order, both as the manifestation, presumably, of his own bodhisattva spirit, and in order to bring that bodhisattva spirit alive for more people. That's what chapter meetings are really about. We're hoping through the chapter meeting that we will come closer and closer to manifesting that bodhisattva spirit. And we've been looking at this in terms of the four Sangraha Vastus and seeing the way in which each Sangraha Vastu can help us to bring about that self-transcendence, mutual self-transcendence, how it can attract people, furthermore, first of all, into the orbit of the movement. It can unify them, it can unite them with us in the order, and once within the order, it can lead to transcendence, self-transcendence, mutual self-transcendence. And really, it's the duty of the chapter convener to exercise the four Sangraha Vastus, or at least to make sure that the Sangraha Vastus are exercised. Of course, it's the duty of everyone to do so, but it's especially the duty of the chapter convener to ensure that, as best he can, to ensure that that is the spirit within which the meeting takes place. As we've seen again and again, the chapter convener has, of course, some special duties, but more than anything, the chapter convener's duty is to ensure that others remember their duty, not by always pointing it out, but by exemplifying it to a very high degree. We'll see this tomorrow more. So we've been looking, first of all, at dana, and we've seen how dana attracts. When you see generosity, you feel drawn. There's a very natural response to generosity. Dana unites because it breaks down the barrier between the person to whom the gift is given and the person who gives it. And finally, it leads to transcendence, because in the act of giving, you challenge the subject-object distinction and in the end have the opportunity of going beyond it altogether. Priyavadita attracts. Loving speech is obviously immediately attractive. You want to participate more in it. You want to be the recipient of it. It unites because it draws people together, and it enables them to cooperate together in a single spiritual community. And finally, it leads to transcendence, because that loving speech arrives at the point where there's no real distinction between the one who speaks and the one who's spoken to. So we're now going to look at Artacharya. It's usually translated as beneficial activity. Arta is means end, goal, or benefit, something of that kind. It's quite a broad term, but in this context, it means the benefit of living beings. And charya is, as in bodhicharya, it's activity. So it's activity which brings benefit to beings in general. Doing good, but that sounds a bit uncomfortable, doesn't it? And obviously, artacharya is attractive. When you see somebody behaving in that sort of way, when you're the recipient of that sort of beneficial activity, well, you feel drawn, you're attracted. And having been attracted, you're united. You feel you want to participate in and contribute to that sort of field of beneficial activity. And that beneficial activity, taken far enough, leads to self-transcendence. So let's look closely at what artacharya means. There are two aspects to it. The first is eradicating suffering. seeing suffering and eliminating it. And the second is bringing about, what you might say, fulfillment, bringing about higher happiness. Because it's not just a question of seeing that people are suffering and removing their suffering. It's also a question of seeing that people are not as fulfilled as they could be and helping them to become so. They may be happy, but they're not as happy as they could be, and they're not beyond the possibility of suffering, at least in the obvious senses. Now, before I begin to look at this much more closely, I want to just tackle two rather unfortunate connotations of the term beneficial activity, especially if you translate it as doing good. Do-gooders, it's a term of abuse, isn't it? So there are two connotations that I want to get us clear of, and that perhaps show us a middle way between them. The first is the connotation of doing good as patronage, patronization rather, so that the one who does good feels superior and removed from the one to whom good is done. Sounds a terrible fate, having good done to you. Sometimes you really feel that good is being done to you and you resent it deeply. And that's because this kind of the attitude of patronization is present within it. It's quite difficult to avoid this if you're self-consciously helping people. And perhaps this is what it comes down to. It's an over-self-consciousness about helping. And I remember this sort of atmosphere when I was briefly involved in social work myself in the early 60s, in the mid-60s. I remember that the very strong sense of us, the social workers, and them, I think they were referred to as the BODs. And the BODs, it was in the context of psychiatric social work, were definitely poor, benighted beings who weren't really, in a certain sense, fully human. I mean, nobody would say that, of course. And above all, we were strongly enjoined not to enter into personal relations with people. Now, there's quite a bit of sense in this because we were dealing with some quite disturbed people. And if you do become involved in personal relations in the wrong sort of way, you can get yourself into serious trouble. I did nearly get pushed under a bus once. So there is some sense in it. But nonetheless, there's something depersonalized, inhuman almost, about that kind of attitude where you are above and separate and isolated in, you know, what is probably a pleasant middle-class life, from within that bubble, helping others. And this is a very unfortunate connotation of charity in general, that you conceive of yourself as above and separate from and untouched by the troubles that you're trying to help. And I don't want to overstress that because there's another side to the whole story, but you probably can see what I mean. That's one extreme. The other extreme is sentimental over-involvement, where you consider that doing good emerges out of your intense emotional identification with those that you're helping. And one hears compassion talked about in this way, even in Buddhist circles. You hear it talked about as a sort of a weeping and breaking down in at the suffering that you see around you. But I think that Atacharya is neither this kind of pseudo-objectivity that's patronizing, nor this sentimentality that's over-involvement. In a certain sense, it's completely objective. It's direct and objective. What sort of brought clarity to this for me was recently reading a paper to Bhante on Plotinus and pity. And the author of the paper asks the question, how does it come about that Plotinus, on the one hand, expends quite a bit of energy knocking pity, as it were, and talking against pity. And on the other hand, was so obviously a deeply compassionate man. For instance, any of his disciples who died leaving young children, he would adopt them, and he would preserve their inheritance and return it to them if they didn't take up a life of philosophy. So the author of the article was sort of wrestling with this puzzle. I think a lot of the difficulty of the article was not clearly distinguishing between pity and compassion. But Bhante said he thought it was quite an important and useful reflection, because he thought that people tended to identify compassion with feeling, with an emotion, and to think that you had to sort of feel deeply in order to be compassionate. And he said that he didn't think it was really like that, and that's what the ancient Greeks, and Plotinus was talking in the context of a very ancient Greek attitude, that's what they were getting at. That you're not compassionate because you feel terribly upset when you see suffering. You just help because you see the need for help. And the response is, as it were, objective in that sense, rather than sentimental, emotional, pitying. So often, what passes for compassion is mere sentimentality and is simply the projection of one's own feelings of suffering and sadness and sorrow onto other people. And it becomes quite complicated in some cases. So for the ancient Greeks, and I think it's really the same for Buddhism, compassion is a completely objective response. You see a need and you fulfill it. Incidentally, Bhante went on to make some quite interesting remarks about what Nietzsche had to say about compassion, because of course he regarded Christianity as importing into Western culture this sort of sentimental notion of compassion, and he saw Nietzsche as in revolt against that sentimental notion. I think, interestingly enough, Bhante didn't say this, my own reflection and therefore fallible, not backed by authority, I think that this sort of notion passed into Romanticism and then into common currency, the notion of compassion as essentially a matter of feeling. But yes, perhaps we should, as often, learn from Nietzsche and go back to the more venerable traditions of European culture in interpreting Buddhism or in finding analogies for Buddhism. Compassion is not pity. It is an entirely objective response. It's a function of awareness. You actually see a need and you just fulfill it. In a way, it's a bit comparable to the sort of awareness that leads you to pick up a cup that you see underneath a chair. You know, you're in a room, there's a meeting going on, everybody's left the room, but one or two people have left their cups under their chairs, and you don't think, oh, I feel terribly upset about the possibility of that cup being broken. You just pick it up and put it on a tray and take it out, cursing slightly the people who left it there under your breath. I don't think that's part of the traditional exposition of compassion. But you see what I mean. It's just a function of your awareness. You see it there, and if your awareness is at all fresh and alive, you could no more leave that cup there than something else that you shouldn't do. You just spontaneously reach down and you pick it up. So in the same sort of way, you see suffering, you see need, and you respond. You see somebody who is, yes, actually suffering, and if you possibly can, you do something about it. You see somebody who needs some help to reveal themselves more fully, to fulfill more of their potential, and you respond. So if compassion, if Artacharya indeed, is a function of our awareness, why is it that we're not as compassionate perhaps as we ought to be, if that's the right word, as it would be natural for us to be. Well, obviously, it's because we don't see. We don't actually see to a sufficiently great degree that the need that's around us. And we don't see it because we're wrapped up in ourselves, because our own needs present themselves to us in such a compelling and cogent way that we don't notice so much what's going on around us. We're too preoccupied with our own interests, with our own sufferings and our own search for opportunity and expansion of ego and so on. Quite natural and inevitable parts of being an embodied human. But they do blot out from us. They make it difficult for us to see the need that's around us. On the other hand, there's another aspect to it, which is more to do with the fact that there's so much need around us. If you really do open your eyes and look around, you see need everywhere. You see the marks of weakness, marks of woe in every face. And in some parts of the world, it's not so much the case here, but in some parts of the world, you just see such direct physical need, material need. It's a very interesting experience for Westerners going for the first time to India, or no doubt other third world countries, that to begin with, it's so strongly affected by the very obvious need that there is around you. And you feel in a very difficult position. You know that, you know, what you're spending in a day while you're travelling would feed, you know, several people for weeks, even months. And, it really is very overwhelming. But then you just watch yourself a few days later and you stop noticing. You stop noticing. In a way, it's quite natural and even sort of necessary. You couldn't go around in that state of horrified, pity in response to the suffering that you see around you, the need that you see around you. You wouldn't be able to get through your day. So, even in the West, we see need all around us so many times. What we do is we close down. We narrow our awareness so that we don't experience what's going on. I think that I do find this very, very interesting shuttling between India and England and noticing my own altered responses in the two situations. And I think it's quite instructive. And there is indeed a context like India, quite a bit of insensitivity. But you can't blame people because there's so much need pressing upon them that they can't remain open to it all. It would take something far, far greater than most people can muster to remain open and sane. So yes, we're both so preoccupied with our own needs and find that the needs around us so overwhelming that we kind of shut down. And we choose to just deal with what we can deal with, which is our own immediate needs and, you know, a little bit of generosity here and there. So if we are to really develop Artacharya, the first thing we need to do is to wake up to the need that's around us. We need to open our awareness in this sort of way. But that's not easy because we so easily then become overwhelmed. And we begin to feel, we begin to feel sentimental responses and we begin to feel despair. What can be done about that overwhelming need that's all around us? Well, to my mind, that the answer to these to this dilemma is Shraddha. We need to have the deep confidence and deep faith in the Dharma as the answer to the sufferings that are around us. We need to feel that if we practice and communicate the Dharma, we are giving what is most needed, what is most necessary to meet the needs that are around us. But we need to feel that very deeply. It's not just, it can't be just a sort of superficial idea that we have, that we sort of paste over the need to make us feel good so that we can say, oh, well, it's all right, I believe in the Dharma, so I don't have to bother about the suffering. It has to be a strong sense that one is living one's life in a way that is an answer to the need that's around one. And so I think that Atacharya needs to arise out of this very strong sense of commitment to a high ideal that is capable of meeting the needs of the world, capable of answering the cries of the world. And indeed, I would say that one's own happiness lay in that response, not in simply taking care of your own needs, but in responding deeply, at the deepest possible level, to the needs of the world. Now, this does raise a quite important consideration. After all, if we do pay attention to need around us, we'll find that it does arise on different levels. What's most blatant is the immediate suffering that we will see, and especially one will see that in a country like India, where there's physical pain and suffering evident to us all the time, physical deprivation and so on. So even here, if we look around, we'll see plenty of suffering in this sense, although it's much, much more obscured. But yes, that's what presents itself to us most cogently, because it's so evident, it's so physically represented. But then if we look a bit closer, we'll see not just physical suffering, but mental suffering, psychological suffering, you could say. The Buddha described it, didn't he, as the pain of knowing that you will lose what you've got, the pain of knowing that you will find yourself put with what you don't want, the pain of knowing that even your present pleasure is not safe, is not secure, knowing that you may be sooner or later forced into proximity with pain again. So it's psychological insecurity. And of course that can become extremely complicated and impacted. It's probably what you're more likely to see on people's faces than the marks of physical deprivation, at least here in the West. Psychological suffering of various kinds, lack of security, unhappiness. But it goes much deeper than that. And it goes to the point at which even somebody can be in physical comfort and abundance. They can even be psychologically relatively happy and healthy, but still have a deeper sense of unfulfillment. A deeper sense of unfulfillment, especially in the face of the fact of death. The fact that everything that we have ultimately will be lost. The fact that everything that we derive meaning from will be removed from us with death. And perhaps even in a more basic sense, a sense of creative unfulfillment, the sense that our lives are not really adding up to what they could add up to, what we sense they could add up to. So a deep sense of existential unfulfillment, which is not necessarily suffering in the sense of physical pain or even mental insecurity, but a sense of being cramped and confined and bored and lacking in fulfillment. So we see suffering on all these different levels, dukkha on all these levels. Direct suffering, dukkha, psychological pain and existential unfulfillment. There's so much of it on all these levels, and perhaps the deeper we look, the more of it we will see. The futility and meaninglessness of so many lives, which you can see that at times catches up with people. They know it's there and they want something more. But there's nothing to suggest to them a way of finding fulfillment. There's so much of that sort of suffering, and on the other levels too. And it can be almost overwhelming. It can be completely overwhelming. Well, it would be overwhelming if we really took it all in. And this is, of course, the meaning of the story of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. That Avalokiteshvara as a sort of ordinary bodhisattva, you might say. I don't know whether this is the way the story would usually be parsed, but let's try it. As an ordinary aspirant bodhisattva looks at the sufferings of the world, and he just can't take it. He knows he can't do anything. He knows that whatever he does do is just a drop in the ocean. And so, you know, at that point, he kind of gives up. Or rather, he as an ordinary being, he gives up and something else takes over, which is represented by the Buddha Amitabha's reassemblage of the bodhisattva into the 11-headed, thousand-armed form. So that the Buddha Amitabha is the transcendental realization manifests within the ruin of the ordinary bodhisattva's being, and creates of it a force that is capable of dealing with the infinite sea of suffering. Well, in a way, of course, that tells us exactly what we must do. That's how we must meet this extraordinary sea of suffering. But perhaps on the way to that, we need to draw on that force and inspiration. We can't do everything. We cannot meet all the demands that will be placed upon us and that the world forces upon us if we open our eyes. So we need to form some sort of means of, to use a rather inelegant term, prioritizing, deciding what is most important, what's most appropriate for us to respond to. We need a kind of plan for our lives that is related to the overwhelming volume of suffering. To give a sort of rather trivial example, if we're walking along the road and we see two unfortunate incidents taking place, well, we have to work out which one to respond to. You know, if on the one hand you see a man get out of a Rolls Royce and drop a coin out of his pocket, well, you know, as a normal decent citizen, you'd go up and pick up the coin and give it back to him, even if he'd come out of a Rolls Royce. You respond to his need. But at that same self-same moment, you see, you know, an old man, poor old man in a old second-hand coat, drop down by the side of the road, clutching his heart. Well, you don't just sort of go and pick up the coin and forget about the other one because you saw it first. You'd spontaneously go to where you saw the greatest need, and you'd forget about the one that was less needful. So in the same sort of way, we need to come in a broader and a longer term way to a decision about where our energies are to go. We need to help where there's most need and where we are most fitted to help. In the end, this is a personal decision that each of us must make. And of course, it's not something that you make finally, as it were. You orient yourself and then respond within that orientation. That orientation may change as the years go by. But yes, we need to respond to all three levels as they arise before us. But I think that probably as Buddhists and as beings trying to meet the need at its most intense, we probably need to pay most attention to the third level, the level of existential unfulfillment, out of which people can, in the fulfillment of which, people can gain the resources to help others with the other two levels. There's a Dharma famine all around us in the world, and that Dharma famine has few enough workers to meet it. There are many social activists. Of course, there are never enough. but there are many, many people who are socially active, but there are very few Dhamma workers. And my own feeling is that whilst we as individuals and perhaps collectively need to meet suffering on the other two levels, certainly we need to make sure that it's on the third level, on the deepest level, that our most concentrated attention needs to go. I think we're often not sufficiently aware of the extent of the need on this deepest level. Of course, we forget just how much we've benefited from the Dhamma ourselves, and often we're so sort of caught up with the daily business of dealing with the incredibly difficult process that spiritual life can be, that we forget just how important it is to us and how greatly we've benefited from it. We don't open our eyes sufficiently to the extent to which so many people are lost in meaninglessness and unfulfillment and feel cramped and confined and uncertain about why they're alive. And we can even as Buddhists just open our eyes to the fact that there are a great many people in the world who would like to practice Buddhism, who explicitly would like to practice Buddhism, but who don't really know what it is and what it means. In India, this is so apparent. There are said to be 10 million Buddhists in India, mainly in Maharashtra. Of those 10 million Buddhists, even if you make it, you look for, 1% of them as having a really serious interest in leading a spiritual life, not merely a good ethical life, that's quite a lot of people. And so few of them really have access to effective teaching. Our own movement is a tiny movement, even in India, and although there are other Buddhists doing good work, they're relatively few. So many people want the Dharma and don't have access to it. And we know in India now that there's a very large potential movement of conversion opening up again. It's very unclear what sort of numbers are involved, but there were about 10 to 20,000 people converted to Buddhism in Delhi last year, in November. And it was said that there could have been 500,000, if not 1,000,000. In Kerala, we're in contact with scheduled caste leaders who are in the beginnings of opening up a new conversion movement, which again could encompass millions of people. Quite literally millions. So just immediately in India, there are so many people who want to become Buddhists. And they'll have no idea what Buddhism really means. They'll become Buddhists because Dr. Ambedkar was a Buddhist, because their leaders now are urging them to become Buddhists, but they'll have very little access to genuine teaching about Buddhism. We heard that, for instance, the person who's leading this mass conversion movement in Delhi went to see the leaders of another Buddhist organization in India, which is one of the biggest Buddhist organizations, and asked, well, what can you do for us? What can you help us with? And so they said, well, we can teach you to conduct weddings. They wouldn't teach them, the three jewels, the Noble Eightfold Path, the five precepts. They just teach them the social dimensions of Buddhism. Of course, that's good. They're needed. But that's not the end of the story. And, our experience so far is that even though the Buddhist conversion movement in India is initially, for many people, a political and social matter, it goes much further than that for quite a considerable number. So I only mention all this because it's such a pressing need right before us at this moment for response. In no other part of the world is it quite so obvious, but it's present. It's very obvious that in the modern West, Buddhism has an extremely high appeal. Many, many people do look to Buddhism, consider Buddhism to be what they'd be if they were anything. That's what the sort of thing they say. And yes, it may be soft Buddhism, it may be pop Buddhism, it may be postmodern Buddhism or whatever, but by goodness, it is Buddhism. They want some meaning for their lives. That they feel the tremendous gap in their lives. And I do personally believe that the hour for Buddhism has really struck, if only we can respond. There's such enormous wealth in the Western world, and it's such extraordinary freedom, completely unprecedented. Never have so many people had such a free range of possibility, and so much wealth to take advantage of that possibility. There's very little restriction on meaningful restriction on people in most modern Western democracies, and very few people really suffer from acute poverty. We know this exists. I'm not trying to skate over that, but there's unbelievable opportunity for so many people in the world today. But what for? What's all that freedom for? What's to be done with it? People don't know. It's just to consume more, to distract yourself more successfully, to have more and more choice and more sophisticated technology and machinery, and to lead a more and more comfortable life. That's what it really amounts to for most people. And one cannot but think that there must be a very considerable number of people who know that it's meaningless and who know that it doesn't go anywhere, and who want to know what to do with this freedom. But there's nothing to tell them. There's nothing in modern culture that convincingly and cogently communicates a deeper meaning to life. And my own view is that this is our hour. Buddhism is uniquely appropriate to this situation of extraordinary freedom and wealth and opportunity. It's uniquely got a message to communicate within that situation. And I think if it doesn't communicate that, we will see social disintegration and increasing unhappiness and catastrophe, even, you might say, on a social scale. That energy has to go somewhere. And if it's not, it doesn't find fulfillment, it'll start to become poisoned. So it seems to me, you've probably noticed the direction of my argument, that's the... It's in terms of meeting the need of people at the deepest level, the need for meaning, the need for spiritual fulfillment, that to which we should respond. That is the need that we are uniquely placed to respond to, and that we are uniquely fitted to respond to, notwithstanding the need to respond on the other levels too. But within the context of a deeper response to the need for meaning, the need, in the end, for Dharma. So, it seems to me that if we open our eyes and look at what's around us, we'll see these needs on all sorts of different levels. If we are sufficiently convinced of the truth and value of the Dharma, we'll feel very strongly that it's the Dharma that is overall, above all, what is needed. And we will be able to remain open to the needs of the world by virtue of responding at that deepest level. But of course, we can't respond alone. We can't respond alone because there's just so much to do. And we probably, none of us, are sufficiently gifted and rounded to be able to respond in a satisfactory way. Is one of the things that's most alarming, isn't it, about teaching the Dharma, is that you know you're teaching people the Dharma, but you're also communicating your own foibles and weirdnesses. And, you know, if that goes on for long enough, you'll manage to have a pretty weird sort of movement on your hands. And it's that the extraordinary genius of somebody like Bhante, that he was able to communicate the Dharma and to start a movement going. His own personality was, of course, imprinted upon it, but he always very conscious of the need for it to go beyond his own personality, and think substantially we do that these days. So you can't do it alone, because none of us have even the talents that Bhante has had. And even if we did, well, we're a particular kind of person. Only a limited range of communication would be possible for us. We need to unite with others just because of the sheer volume of the work and the nature of the work. But also what we're trying to communicate is not a theory or an idea merely. It's a spirit. And that spirit is best communicated in the form of social relations. If people see the Dharma embodied in the Sangha, it communicates far more powerfully than just communicated through words. If the words are placed in the context of the Sangha, they impress much more powerfully and move much more powerfully. So I think we can't do it alone, because what we really have to offer is a spirit that lives between people. So we need the cooperation of other people. But even that isn't enough. We can't really get very far unless what we're drawing upon is something that goes beyond us as individuals. We need the cooperation, you might say, of mighty forces. We need the cooperation of a power that goes way beyond the merely personal. We need the cooperation, in other words, of the bodhicitta, of the bodhisattva, of the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Because it's only that can transcend the sheer volume and intensity of need all around us. As Shanti Deva says, the power of evil is always great, and the possibility of good is relatively small. By what other good could evil be overcome than by the bodhicitta? Because the bodhicitta transcends even the distinction between evil and good. It meets evil and good, evil on a level beyond evil. So it's only the non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy that can meet the sheer volume of need. And our order is bodhisattva. Our order is, literally, Bhante says, the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. It does, to some extent, embody that non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, and it aspires to manifest that non-egoistic stream more and more effectively as time goes by. Not only is the order a bodhisattva, the chapter is a bodhisattva. When we meet together in a chapter, we meet in the spirit of the founding of the order, the bodhisattva spirit, which is the founding of the order. We meet as aspirant bodhisattvas who've committed ourselves to the bodhisattva ideal in our ordination, and we aspire through our meeting to transcend ourselves and to become hands of Avalokiteshvara. We need to be giving up to the bodhisattva, to be calling upon that energy if we're to be able to respond to the need that is around us. So the chapter is attempting to invoke that spirit that is the ultimate answer to the needs of the world, which we cannot but see if we open our eyes. So in our chapter, we need to be consciously activating the spirit of Artacharya. We need to be consciously engaging in and meeting in a context of altruistic activity. Artacharya should be part of the tone of the meeting. Now, I think this is really quite an unusual way of looking at a chapter meeting, and perhaps even quite hard to understand exactly what it means in practice. But when we meet, the spirit of Artacharya should be there. First of all, that means, of course, that our meeting with each other should activate our responses to each other. If we see need in other members of the chapter, we should respond in that direct, objective way. So we should be alive to each other as individuals who suffer or who are more or less unfulfilled. And we should respond to each other, to the dukkha that we see in each other on whatever level it may be, with an objective response of trying to help, not with a kind of self-conscious, preformed idea of helping, and not with a sort of sentimentalized helping, but just with a direct, immediate contribution, response. whether it's at the level of just here's a fiver to go to an order weekend, mind you, you can see how long it is since I paid for an order weekend. Here's 500 quid to go to an order weekend. do you want to have a chat sometime? Whatever it may be, a direct response to other members of the chapter, to their needs, to their obvious needs on whatever level they may be. Then I think that we should also make sure that in our communication with each other, in, for instance, our confiding with each other, the altruistic dimension of our own lives should be communicated. Not that we're sort of saying, you know, I did not as kind of spiritual Boba Job week, which you report in at the end of the week. But if you are alive in that sort of way, that should be part of your communication. You should be in some way getting across your response to the needs that you get, that you see around you, especially so that you can develop your capacity to respond to a greater extent. And perhaps even you should be admitting, confessing your own failures to respond. It's very interesting to see that a Sangha considers ethics from three points of view. I think this goes back further than a Sangha too. But he argues that ethics is, first of all, the ethics of restraint. It's stopping yourself from doing unskillful things. And then it's the ethics of developing positive qualities. So bringing into being metta and dhyana states and so on and so forth. But thirdly, there's the ethics of benefiting beings. It's sattva arta kriya shila. It's interesting, of course, there's arta kriya, which is really the same as artacharya. It's exactly the same meaning. So that for a sangha, benefiting others is a question of ethics. Because if you're not benefiting others, you're cutting yourself off. You're identifying yourself exclusively with yourself and not entering into the needs of others. And that is an ethical question, which I think is a very helpful way of looking at things. So when we're confessing, when we're communicating about ourselves, our failure to respond to others should be part of what we confess. And our successful response to others should be part of our confiding. We should be letting others know about the altruistic aspects of our lives. Now, of course, we're probably rightly a little reticent about this. We don't want to boast. We don't want to turn our altruistic activity into some kind of good conduct medal or anything of that kind. But as so often in these questions, that by trying to avoid something bad, we avoid something good. By not communicating about this dimension, we may avoid falling into egoistic appropriation of it, but we lose the benefit of communicating something that's important to us, and therefore of making it even more important to us. If we don't communicate about it, it doesn't develop, doesn't grow. So perhaps within our chapters we should be, you know, in all humility, a little less reticent, if you see what I mean. So that the altruistic dimension of our lives, I think, should be part of the currency of our communication, not in some artificial and overblown way. I'm sure you know I mean that. But it should be part of what's apparent about us to others, and especially our struggles to open up more to the needs that we see around us, and our struggles to calibrate how to respond. It's not an easy matter. Every day, if you're really alive, you're not responding to some things, and you're choosing to respond to other things. What do you do when you hear an appeal on the radio, for instance, for something that's, you do feel very affected by? You know, there's a terrible earthquake in Afghanistan just in the last 2 days, on top of everything else. Well, obviously there are appeals for money for that. Well, what do you do? Do you respond to that? And if you don't, why don't you? Is it because you feel, well, you've had to make a decision about where you will put the emphasis of your own altruistic activity, and you can't take on everything? Or is it just that, well, you know, there's so many things going on, you just don't listen. You need to be able to communicate about that kind of struggle, because it's a very, very real one. As human beings, we cannot but feel for other human beings. We cannot but see and identify with other human beings. And the nature of our response is, I think, a very important and trying question for us. And, of course, what we try to do, in the worst case, is sort of build a life that's protected from all these insistent demands upon us, so that we don't notice them. And what we try to do, I think, as Buddhists, is to take them on head on and have a kind of what we consider to be the most intelligent and effective policy in relation to them. But nonetheless, there are always going to be issues arising. Well, you'd think that those would be coming up quite a bit. Maybe they did. Maybe they do. I don't know. But let's say that they should be part of the currency of communication within a chapter. The altruistic dimension of our lives should be part of what we're communicating about, because surely it's vital to us. Then thirdly, I think that within a chapter, there needs to be, or it would be good if there was, some collective altruism. I think it would be very good, or I put it to you to consider the possibility that it might be very good, if a chapter together undertook some altruistic activity, whether it is doing a class together, or raising some money together, or simply going out of your way to help somebody in particular. But I think it would be very, very good if the chapter came together to do something for others. The more you can do, the better. But I think that even if you did just a little, if the chapter had a sort of charitable dimension, you might say, even at that level, that you just put money together week by week and then every now and again decided what you were going to do with it, I think this would have a very positive effect on the chapter, so that the practice of Artacharya would actually unite you, because you would be joining in it together. Yeah, I know there are some chapters who do this, that they collect money and they use it to help an order member in difficulties, for instance. But I think it doesn't have to be confined to that sort of thing. And I think it'd be very good if one actually did something together. You know, whether it's going to paint an old lady's house, or, do a class together, or support an Indian Dhammachari who's doing Dhamma work, or whatever it might be, that one comes together, that you come together in your chapter to help on a common project. Then fourthly, I think it's very important that in a chapter there's a strong recognition of the common task that we've adopted. If the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara is the order, if the order is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, well, then we're united in altruistic activity. Of course, we're all hands of Avalokiteshvara, or ideally are hands of Avalokiteshvara. So we're reaching out in different places with different implements to different people. But we're united in a single enterprise. And I do think that this dimension of things needs to be brought to life more within the order. There's this old and hoary distinction made between the order and the movement. And you have a small fashion for order members saying that they're involved with the order but not with the movement. I don't think this really washes, frankly. It depends what you mean by the movement, of course, but I don't think it really washes. Because I think what it really means in the end is, if you are saying that you're involved in the order but not in the movement, that you're an arahat in the old sense that doesn't exist. You're saying that your spiritual life has got nothing to do with other people. You're not engaged in altruistic activity. Because to me, the movement is not any particular organization. It's the sum total of the altruistic activity of order members. The movement is what order members do to help other people, to respond to the cries of the world. Of course, a major part of that response is through particular organizations, centres and classes and so on and so forth. Well, you don't have to be involved with those, but I think there must be an altruistic dimension to one's activity which one feels one has in common with other order members, so that you feel, well, you're doing what you're doing, but it's part of our collective response. And you feel that you can concentrate on what you're concentrating on because others are doing other things too. I find this personally, that because we do have a response to the direct material sufferings that there are in the world through Karuna and Bahujin Hitai in India, well, I feel a little bit easier about focusing my attentions mainly on Dhamma activity. Whilst I think that it's important that that Dhamma activity is our principal focus, I do think that collectively we need to have some response to suffering on other levels as well. Otherwise, in a way, one feels almost cut off from those sufferings and feels that one isn't attending to them at all. So it seems to me very important that we overcome this idea that the order and the movement are completely distinct, and that you can be involved in the order and not in the movement. What I would say is that the order and movement are distinct but not separate. You cannot have the order without the movement. You cannot have the movement without the order. The latter is obvious. If you don't have an order, then the movement has no meaning. But the order surely is not the order. It cannot be the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara if it does not have a movement, if it does not have a collective altruistic dimension. And I think it's very important that order members in chapters are able to realize their participation in our collective altruistic activity. And I think it's especially important that order members do not indulge in negation of other people's altruistic activity within the order. One might be critical of it, one might think that it could be done better, but it should not be negated. One should feel a sympathy and identity with what all order members are doing, even if you feel that you have something to contribute to helping them to do it better and to removing the less than fortunate elements of it. So I think it's very, very important that the whole tendency and trend of a chapter meeting should be to help order members to feel their identity with the order as a whole, and especially with its altruistic dimension. I think this might be a sort of rather new perspective, if you see what I mean. It's always been implicit, but perhaps it's being drawn out in a more explicit way than before, and perhaps something that we do need to give attention to. Is this altruistic dimension really a part of your chapter's functioning? Do you really act altruistically towards each other? Is your own personal altruistic activity shared with others in your chapter? Are you confessing your shortcomings and failings in response, and your own struggles to evaluate and quantify the best direction of your altruistic activity, and your own triumphs in altruism? Is there some collective altruism amongst you in your chapter? And do you all feel your participation in the common altruistic activity of the order as the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara? And all of that amounts to Artacharya, engaging in the Sangrahavastu of Artacharya. Surely, if this Sangrahavastu is alive in the chapter, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara will manifest and will take us over, so that we will be hands and even faces of Avalokiteshvara, and so we will respond to the overwhelming need that there is all around us.